Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week on Talking History, we take up the American Revolution once again, but from a different perspective. We'll be examining the role of those who supported the British, or, as they've come to be known, the Loyalists or the Tories. In particular, we'll look at the Loyalists in New York. Our guest will be Philip Ranlett, professor of history at Hunter College. And after that, historian James Brooks fills us in on a slavery history few know, Native American slavery in the Southwest. But first, Joyce Gidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 8, 1915, D.W. Griffith's controversial film Birth of a Nation premiered in Los Angeles. Because of its content, it's regarded as extremely racist, but it is also hailed as a landmark in cinematic history due to its pioneering technical achievements. The film, based on the play The Klansman, written by Thomas Dixon, Jr., depicts the American South during the Civil War and Reconstruction and the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, denounced it for his vicious portrayal of blacks. Nevertheless, Birth of a Nation became one of the biggest box office moneymakers in history, and in 1998 was ranked number 44 in the top 100 American films of all time.
New York City fell to the British early in the war for American independence, and it remained in British hands until the end of the war. Not coincidentally, it became a stronghold of pro-British sentiment. But just how many Loyalists were there in New York? Why did they resist the Patriot cause? What was life like for them behind British lines? And what happened to them when their side lost? Philip Ranlett tells all in his talk recorded for The Teacher is Historian and Talking History at WNYE-FM in New York City. Ranlett is a professor of history at Hunter College in New York and the author of New York Loyalists.
Everyone seems to know one thing about the allegiance of Americans during the American Revolution. One-third supported the Revolution and became patriots. One-third opposed it and became Loyalists, or as they were often called, Tories, and one-third were neutral. That came from a letter of John Adams, but he was talking about the French Revolution, not the American. In reality, Loyalists were a small, usually powerless minority everywhere. New York, however, because of its opposition to the violence of many patriots, was suspected of being a Tory province. New York would be put to the test many times during the war, and the British were disappointed at the lack of loyalism. Tories were no more than 15% of the population of New York State. The American Revolution did not begin with the clashes of armies. It began because the British Parliament decided to tax the 13 colonies. Great Britain was heavily in debt because of the French and Indian War, which ended in 1763. 2 years later, Parliament passed the Stamp Act in 1765, which taxed business papers, legal documents, including diplomas, newspapers, and many other things. Colonists were not represented in Parliament, and Americans insisted that only their own representatives could tax them. Violence was employed against the stamp taxes, especially in Massachusetts. New York, however, would quickly go far beyond even the New Englanders. In October 1765, tax stamps for New York were placed in Fort George, located in downtown New York City. Riots broke out on November 1st and would continue well into 1766. A resistance group called the Sons of Liberty led the violent protest against the Stamp Act. The Sons of Liberty would be opposed by more moderate men. These moderates were strongly against parliamentary taxation, but were just as opposed to the violent tactics of the Sons of Liberty. The moderate men, many of whom would later become loyalists in years to come, decided to use non-importation against the stamp tax. New York's merchants vowed not to import British goods until the Stamp Act was repealed. The moderates beat the stamp tax. Non-importation won. The Stamp Act was eliminated in 1766, and the violent mobs that had frightened New Yorkers finally ended. But New York's moderate men did not forget the violence caused by the Sons of Liberty. The moderates realized that if parliamentary taxation arose again, they had to assert themselves and take control of the resistance to it. If they did not, the Sons of Liberty would again use mob violence. The moderates would work hard to prevent that over the next 10 years. Parliamentary taxation surfaced again with the passage of the Townshend Taxes in 1767. colonial resistance heated up in 1768 when non-importation resumed. In New York, moderates dominated the resistance committee and tried to control the New York Sons of Liberty. Most of the time, the moderates succeeded. But in 1770, the Sons of Liberty, led by Isaac Sears, got a taste of their old power. In January 1770, Sears and his supporters fought with British soldiers at a place called Golden Hill. By May 1770, the moderates learned that many Americans, including the Bostonians, had violated non-importation. The moderates, with the support of most New Yorkers, ended non-importation, except for British tea, which was still being taxed. The Sons of Liberty, who had wanted the complete trade ban to continue, were defeated once again. The boycott of British tea continued, and the colonial crisis intensified in 1773 when Parliament passed the Tea Act. This notorious act was meant to help the British East India Company, which was burdened with debt because New Yorkers and other Americans refused to buy their tea. Anger over the Tea Act resulted, in April 1774, in an act of violence. At that time, a New York mob boarded a ship in New York's harbor and tossed a cargo of taxed British tea into the water. Boston was not the only city with its own tea party. New York's moderates realized they had to act again. They dominated the Committee of 51, which was created after New York's tea party. Rather than immediately start up non-importation again and be tricked by cheating Bostonians, the moderates insisted on the calling of what became the First Continental Congress. This Congress called for non-importation, and New York joined in again. Moderates would again dominate the New York Committee formed to enforce the Acts of Congress. The New York Sons of Liberty were frustrated by their lack of power and infuriated by one of their chief enemies, the future loyalist James Rivington. Rivington published a New York newspaper that printed essays by both friends and enemies of parliamentary taxation. Rivington also made a point of ridiculing Isaac Sears, the leader of the Sons of Liberty. Rivington printed some pamphlets by future loyalists. The most famous was a Church of England minister, Samuel Seabury, whose pen name was the Westchester Farmer. He attacked mobs, riots, and the Congress. Another Anglican minister, Thomas Bradbury Chandler of New Jersey, gained the distinction of having one of his pamphlets burned in two New York taverns on its day of publication. Chandler attacked the Sons of Liberty and feared what he saw as a movement towards republicanism. Both Seabury and Chandler expressed their opposition to parliamentary taxation. As 1775 began, the colonial crisis continued to escalate. In January 1775, New York's Colonial Assembly refused to accept the Continental Congress. The New York Assemblymen then found themselves called Loyalists, although they also opposed parliamentary taxation. By April 1775, the New York Sons of Liberty tried to harass a New York merchant who had sold some straw and boards to the British Army. As this did not involve implements of war, the merchant had not violated any regulation. He complained to city officials who arrested Sears, but the Sons of Liberty rescued him and declared that a Son of Liberty should not have to pay bail, and they gained control of the streets. A disturbed commentator observed, "While we are determined to contend against the tyranny of a British Parliament and ministry, that has not established the sway of a mob, which includes despotism, the most cruel and severe of all others. Let us remember that the restraints of the law all the security of liberty." While the streets of New York were surging with chaos, news of the battles of Lexington and Concord in April 1775 reached the city. The old royal government collapsed immediately. New York's moderate men reacted again and dominated a new committee. Sears lost his remaining influence and moved to Connecticut, but Sears had not finished with New York. In November 1775, Sears decided to silence prominent loyalists of New York. Leading a gang of 80 men, Sears left Connecticut and seized Samuel Seabury and others in Westchester. When Sears and his men entered Manhattan, they took all of Rivington's printing types and returned to Connecticut. New Yorkers reacted to this escapade of Sears with complete outrage. Rivington, though, had been silenced. Patriots in New York now controlled the government, and so loyalists began to surface. In Queens County on Long Island, loyalists who were mostly members of the Church of England appeared in the towns of Hempstead, Oyster Bay, and Jamaica. These loyalists greatly embarrassed the Patriot government when they voted against sending delegates to a New York provincial congress in November 1775. The Patriots were so upset with Queens that they sent over 1,000 soldiers there and arrested 20 important Tories. About 250 loyalists decided to hide in the swamps and forests of Queens and waited for the British. Another bastion of loyalism was Staten Island. Led by Anglicans, Staten Island voted against being represented in a Patriot legislature. Threatened by the Patriots, Staten Island gave in, at least publicly. The Staten Islanders resisted in other ways. They were slow to give supplies to the Patriots, and Staten Islanders committed acts of sabotage. Loyalism also appeared in Westchester. Several Anglican ministers led the Tories there. Although Loyalists were a minority in Westchester, they had enough strength to scare the Patriots. New York Loyalists had to wait until the British returned to the province with a mighty fleet and army during the summer of 1776. In July 1776, the British landed on Staten Island and were welcomed by the Loyalists. Unfortunately for them, this was an army of conquest, not liberation. One British officer related what happened to Staten Island. "The fair nymphs of this isle are in wonderful tribulation, as the fresh meat our men have got here has made them as riotous as satyrs. A girl cannot step into the bushes to pluck a rose without running the most imminent risk of being ravished, and they are so little accustomed to these vigorous methods that they don't bear them with the proper resignation, and of consequence we have most entertaining courts-martial every day."
You're listening to Talking History and Philip Randlett speaking on Loyalists in New York during the American Revolution.
In August, the British Army landed on Long Island and moved through Brooklyn. The British expected hordes of Loyalists to join them, but few appeared. Only when they reached Queens did the British find substantial Loyalist support. Helped by these Tories, the British defeated the Patriots on Long Island. The next goal of the British was New York City. With the fall of Staten Island and Long Island, Manhattan could not be defended. The people of New York City suffered all the horrors of war starting on September 15, 1776, when the British conquered it. A few days later, some Patriots started the terrible fire already described. About one quarter of the wooden city was destroyed. The Tories who stayed in British-occupied New York City endured all the problems typical of a military occupation. The bureaucracy of the British military was hopelessly corrupt. The once clean city was choked by garbage tossed into the streets. Civil government barely existed. One cynic observed, "If any author had an inclination to write a treatise upon stinks, he never could meet with more subject matter than in New York." And the city had become a violent place. British sailors rioted and drunken soldiers murdered. New Yorkers learned to stay off the streets at night. And in what is today Brooklyn, near the site of the old Navy Yard, American prisoners of war suffered in terrible prison ships. The most infamous was called the Jersey. Thousands of Patriots died aboard those notorious hellholes. Such conditions were made even worse by the harsh winters of the Revolution. During the winter of 1779 and 1780, the cold was so intense that all of New York's harbor froze, the only time that happened in recorded history. And the British alienated still more New Yorkers when scarce firewood was diverted to favored individuals. Even a noted Tory such as James Rivington was alienated. He had reopened his newspaper during the British occupation and had to deal with censorship imposed by the British military. Quickly, Rivington angered some British officers by printing material that was not flattering to a former British commander. Because of British censorship, the printer could not publicly battle his current antagonists. Instead, he turned to spying for his old foes, the Patriots. In return for being a spy, Remington would be allowed to stay in New York City. He would also be paid well for his switching sides. It appears he provided the Americans with some vital information. The British did try to calm the discontent of Loyalists by appointing two important New Yorkers to important positions. William Smith, a historian and royal counselor, was named Chief Justice of the province. Andrew Elliot, a very popular man, was made Lieutenant Governor. Elliot was also put in charge of the Board of Police of New York City. It was hoped that Elliot leading the police would lessen the harshness of the martial law that governed occupied New York. But Elliot was a very cautious man, and instead of judging many cases, simply sent them to the British. In contrast to Elliot, Long Island's chief of police, George D. Ludlow, took so much power in his hands that he was called the King of the Island. However, the worst police official had to be New York City's mayor, David Matthews. Not only did he know little about the law, he was accused of charging high fees and embezzling supplies meant for the poor. The Loyalists in Occupy New York soon learned that they had no recourse to law whenever they ran afoul of the British Army. Every arrogant act of the British seems to have alienated a Tory. Given the many abuses committed by the British, the number of alienated Loyalists had to be very large. The war had other fronts in New York State. In 1777, the British planned what they thought was a master stroke. An army would go south from Canada, seize Albany and the Hudson River, thus isolating rebellious New England from the other colonies. Indeed, New York State's geography made it a vital area during the American Revolution. The British picked General John Burgoyne to lead this army intended to conquer the rest of New York. General Burgoyne believed that this invasion would be more like a triumphant parade than a military struggle. Burgoyne, like most British generals, believed that the state of New York was overwhelmingly loyal to the king. Only brute force exercised by patriot leaders kept the loyal population from returning to their real allegiance. When the British army appeared, the Tories would overthrow their oppressive leaders and join Burgoyne. Burgoyne's confidence swelled even more when in July 1777 his army captured legendary Fort Ticonderoga without a shot being fired. But as the British advanced through the extensive territory of northern New York, few Loyalists joined them. In fact, the people fled as his army approached. By August, Burgoyne's army was in desperate need of supplies, and the general dispatched a force to seize Bennington, Vermont. Reportedly, that town had the needed supplies and Tories would join en route. Burgoyne's men never got to Bennington. They were beaten badly by Patriot soldiers, some of whom had pretended to be Tories. Still, Burgoyne did not retreat. He realized by now that the great majority of New Yorkers were Patriots, but he imagined that nearer Albany there were enough Loyalists to help him. So Burgoyne's army kept marching south until, finally, they could no longer retreat. Burgoyne soon had another burden. Some of his Indian allies killed a young Tory woman named Jane McCrae. She had wanted to join a fiancé who was with the British Army. McCrae's death caused tremendous fury in northern New York and inspired countless more patriots to oppose the British invasion. After a series of hopeless battles, Burgoyne had no choice but to surrender in October 1777. Burgoyne's disastrous campaign had the ultimate effect of bringing France into the war on the side of the Patriots, thus helping to bring about their ultimate victory. Why did Burgoyne fail to attract the Loyalists? The British had depended on overconfident predictions of Loyalist strength in New York. Burgoyne put the idea of a Tory New York to the test in 1777. Loyalists failed to appear because, for the most part, they did not exist. Because the Burgoyne campaign had depended upon a large turnout of Tories, it was doomed from the start. Another important military front during the American Revolution was Westchester, especially its southern part, which is today called the Bronx. The British entered Westchester in October 1776 and were welcomed by Tories in Rye. But the Westchester Loyalists were soon shocked by the conduct of British troops and the Hessians, German mercenaries who aided the British. The invaders raped and plundered their way through the county. Samuel Seabury's Tory-filled parish, which was in the Bronx, was devastated. Within a few months, southern Westchester was unsafe for travelers without an armed guard. Thieves infested the area, and the surviving inhabitants feared everybody they saw. Too frightened to take sides, the people there drifted into neutrality. Southern Westchester became the neutral ground. The British had destroyed an area that should have been a loyalist stronghold. The violence in the Bronx was blamed unfairly upon a loyalist cavalry unit eventually commanded by James Delancey, often called simply the Refugees or, by patriots, Delancey's Cowboys. The term cowboy, today associated with the American West, originated in New York, where it meant thief. Although Delancey's Cowboys were not undisciplined thieves, they gained a reputation for cruelty and lawlessness. By 1779, loyalism was weak in Westchester. Both loyalists and patriots had been plundered. The patriots punished captured thieves. The British did not seem to punish anyone. So ended the allegiance of the Westchester loyalists to the British crown. Treatment of Tories by the patriots varied during the war. In patriot-held areas, various committees dominated the countryside. A local committee became, in effect, the local government. Someone suspected of loyalism would be brought before the committee and asked to explain his conduct. Usually, a case would be dismissed if the suspect willingly took an oath of allegiance to the revolutionaries. If a suspect refused to say the oath, he would be imprisoned. Jails of this time were terrible places, and jail keepers were sometimes as bad as the jails. Charges of cruelty and embezzlement were common enough. Detentions for long periods without a trial hurt the health of Tories. However, the patriots tried to care for sick prisoners, and sometimes paid for medical care. Sometimes an ill loyalist was permitted to go home until he recovered. Loyalists thought to be especially dangerous were exiled to other states. New York Tories were sent to Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and Connecticut. Unlucky loyalists suffered in Connecticut's Simsbury Mines. They were held 70 feet underground for many months. New York was thorough in its attempts to confiscate the property of loyalists. Most land confiscations were in northern New York State. On October 24, 1781, sounds of rejoicing in New Jersey over an American victory awakened loyalists' fears about their future. The Tories soon learned that Lord Cornwallis had surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia. Although some loyalists thought Britain could still win the war, most realized that the mother country had tired of spending millions of pounds with no results. During August 1782, Tories who still expected victory were shocked by official news that England had accepted the independence of her former colonies. In November 1783, the British completed the evacuation of New York City. To prevent any violence, the American army immediately entered. Staten Island and New Utrecht were given up by the British in early December, thus ending over 100 years of British rule in New York. Those Tories who had stayed behind expected a bloodbath, but to everyone's surprise, New York City was peaceful. Who were the New York Loyalists? On Long and Staten Island and in New York City, they were either Anglicans or those of other faiths who were influenced by an Anglican minister or some other staunch Tory. After the British invasion, they were joined by those New Yorkers who assumed that the British were on the verge of victory. Sometimes an influential minister, a retired British officer, or royal official could stir up additional numbers for the king's cause. Although Tories were sometimes influential people, one should remember that loyalists were vastly outnumbered by patriots. When the revolution ended, many Tories left America and journeyed to an exile in Canada or England.
You've been listening to Philip Ranlett, professor of history at Hunter College and the author of New York Loyalists. For our commentary of the week, we've invited James Brooks to tell us about a different kind of slavery in the United States. Brooks is a member of the research faculty at the School of American Research in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the author of Captives and Cousins, Slavery, Kinship, and Community in the Southwest Borderlands, published by the University of North Carolina Press.
In his journeys along the Santa Fe Trail in the 1820s, the American trader Josiah Gregg remarked often upon the presence of captive Mexicans among the Comanches and Kiowas who bartered mules and horses with his merchant caravans. Mostly women and children, their social status seemed ambiguous to Gregg, himself more familiar with chattel slavery in the American South. One woman, although her father had raised a ransom to buy her freedom, preferred to remain with her masters. Gregg reported that the Comanches had disfigured her by tattooing, that she was married and perhaps pregnant, and that she would be more unhappy returning to her father under these circumstances than by remaining where she was. Gregg called her condition voluntary captivity, an ambivalent term that reflected a challenge to the binary world of freedom and slavery from which he hailed. Like Gregg, we today struggle to make sense of an institution that was neither freedom nor slavery by the standards of conventional American history. The Mexican women and children whom Gregg met inhabited a world somewhere between indigenous forms of coercive kin-making and the fiercely modern slave regime then taking shape in the sugarcane fields and cotton plantations east of the Mississippi River. In the southwest borderlands, peoples like Comanches, Kiowas, Apaches, Pawnees, and Pueblo Indians had seized captives, adopted them as kinspeople, or assimilated them as slaves, long before the advent of Euro-Americans. When Spanish colonists arrived in the 17th century, they too used the practice of ransom to bind workers to their households, often purchasing captives from Apache and Comanche raiders. By the 19th century, the Southwest slave system had expanded into Mexico, with powerful pastoralists like Comanches and Kiowas plundering villages and haciendas for their horses, mules, and cattle, as well as the labor to manage them. When Anglo-Americans entered the region, cattle barons like John Chisholm proved eager buyers for surplus slaves. Human bondage, therefore, born of economic urgency and tempered by indigenous kinship systems, lay behind the experience of Mexican women and children that Gregg encountered in the Indian encampments. Southwestern slavery would not end until the Civil War itself moved west in the decades after 1865. The liminality of these victims' experience, so evident in the Mexican woman who, her face tattooed with symbols marking her simultaneously as Comanche to some and barbarian to others, and her womb embracing the evidence of both violation and her hope for a future, is haunting. This violent constellation of emotional, cultural, and material exchange produced a history by which the peoples of the Southwest were drawn, in the words of the poet, closer and closer apart. The story of American slavery must be stretched to accommodate these stories. Doing so may alert us to new questions about the terrible intimacies beneath the familiar architecture of African enslavement in the South, and to reconsider any easy distinctions we may draw between American slavery and American freedom.
And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore producer, Fiona Beatty assistant producer. Philip Randlett's talk on the New York Loyalist was produced at WNYE in New York City by Erwin Gonchek. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.